Lovers of bees and the products they provide gather in Ashland this weekend. The Oregon Honey and Mead Festival returns for another round of events on Saturday at a couple of downtown venues. Bees are big business, with more and more fans of their pollination work and all it produces all the time. Two guests join us. Sharon Schmidt is a beekeeper and the founder of the Oregon Honey and Mead Festival. Thanks for joining us in the studio.
Thank you, Jeff.
And we also have with us Amina Harris, who's the director of the Honey and Pollination Center at the University of California, Davis. Hi, Amina.
Hi there.
Good to have you both here today. Sharon, let's start with you and just talk about the Honey and Mead Festival generally and how you got it started.
Well, we started it 5 years ago. This is our fifth annual Honey and Mead Festival, and we're really excited about it. It started because honey has always seemed kind of magical to me. I grew up in a family that came from a farming background, and while we didn't have bees, there was something that was communicated about them that was kind of irresistible. So when I got the chance, I got into beekeeping, and as I've said many times, honey was sort of gateway drug for me to get to beekeeping. It worked out really well.
So it started with the honey and worked into the beekeeping?
It did.
And so, Amina, how did this become a career for you to be the director of the Honey and Pollination Center?
Well, I've sort of been in the industry a very long time, almost 40 years. During that hippie era in the 60s and 70s, when people were trying to figure out alternative ways to eat, I was busy trying to convert my New York Times cookbook into a natural food cookbook and using honey for lots of recipes and making jams and jellies. And then the person I married, my husband, Ishai Zeldner, who was a beekeeper and had started a honey business. So I joined him and a company that was then called Moonshine Trading Company. And we started selling varietal honeys long before people ever thought about them because he was in love with yellow star thistle and knew that really good orange blossom was very hard to come by. And that there was all these nuances to honey. So he knew all that, but none of us really knew how to market it or what we were doing. So essentially, that's where I started. That was in, like, 1980, so a long time ago. And I've been doing it ever since. About 5 years ago, 6 years ago, actually, I was asked to become the director of the Honey and Pollination Center at UC Davis. And I've been doing a whole lot of research and work on honey ever since then.
You mentioned varietals. People are used to using that, hearing that term with wine, not so much honey. How many different, what makes a different varietal with honey? It's not people adding flavors. It's something natural to the process. Is that right?
Exactly. It's all very natural. So the wonderful thing about honey is maybe there's two wonderful things. One is half the people that I speak with have no clue that there is such a thing as varietal honey. And part of that is because they don't grow up in an area where there's different honeys. I just did a presentation to Canadians, and I realized after I was all done that they'd never smelled orange blossoms because they don't bloom.
There are no orange blossoms, right?
You know. So with that kind of background, you're going, oh, right, I should have addressed this a little differently. On the other hand, there are actually over 300 varietal honeys produced throughout the United States. And every single varietal varies according to the floral source that it comes from. And when I say varies, it varies by color, it varies by smell, it varies by how it crystallizes or doesn't crystallize. I mean, every aspect of it is unique, and they all taste different. And they, you know, they have different, you could use them differently in your life if you really want to get into it, which someone like Sharon has.
You mentioned yellow star thistle, which anytime I hear that, it's usually along the lines of, ow, I have a yellow star thistle stuck in my sock. And so I'm really surprised to hear that it has a usefulness to somebody making honey.
Right. So yellow star thistle is the honey that everybody loves to hate. it's actually what started my family business.
Really?
Yellow star thistle used to be in great supply throughout Northern California. It is an invasive weed. I have to admit that. It is also producing one of the best honeys that you can get out of Northern California, though there's been so much work to eradicate it that it's harder and harder to come by. But it's a honey that's like a candy sweet honey, as opposed to some of the heavier ones that I always say, if you're going to make a candy, make it taste like yellow star thistle. Instead, they always make it taste like a cough drop. You know?
Amina Harris is one of our guests on the Jefferson Exchange, the director of the Honey and Pollination Center at the University of California, Davis, knows a lot about honey, and we'll be offering some honey tasting lessons at the Oregon Honey and Mead Festival, for which Sharon Schmidt is the founding director and beekeeper herself. She's in the studio with me. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Things you've always wanted to know about honey and bees, here's your chance to find out a bit more. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And Sharon, is there any significance to anything involving bee life cycles about the timing of the Oregon Honey and Mead Festival?
Well, yes, actually. We tried to make it in the fall so that beekeepers would be pretty much done with their extraction process. However, the weather has defeated us a little bit in terms of, you know, having had a great season. This smoke is devastating for people, but it's also very difficult for bees. For example, I was able to extract some honey by putting the extractor on my truck, basically. And normally you can't do this. You can't extract outside. I was able to do that, and no bees showed up, which is, like, unheard of. So the smoke is thick enough that they can't smell what they need to smell.
Ah, which is why people always use smoke to try to get bees to move away from places.
Exactly. So we presently we don't need any smoke to open hives. We can just use maybe sugar water and spray them with a little bit of sugar water so that they don't fly up at you. But they're probably having difficulty finding forage for so many different reasons, and this is one of them.
So does this mean that the honey is coming in late? It's just not happening yet, or what's going on with the process itself?
Presently, there's a nectar dearth, so there isn't much nectar to be had. Whatever they've collected during this season is probably going to be pretty much it for them. So bees are going to have to be fed.
So let's get back, Amina, to one of the real basics then. I mean, what is honey? I used to watch I used to watch one of those kids' science shows on Saturday morning, and there was one time when the assistant said, "You mean honey is bee barf?"
Oh, right. We hear that a lot, but it's actually not. Bees actually have two stomachs, which most people don't know. And one stomach is their honey stomach, and it's what they carry their nectar in, and it's where invertase is. And invertase is the enzyme that transforms nectar or helps to start the process of nectar into honey. So when bees collect nectar, they're collecting something that is 80% moisture. It's 80% water. And when you get honey, if it's been cured properly inside the hive, it'll be between 17.5% and 19% moisture. So they have to get rid of a whole lot of water. And that process starts right in the honey stomach. Now, they have a second stomach with which they eat, and it's right next door. But the food that they're going to eat goes into the honey, into their own stomach, and the food that they're going to turn into honey does not. And so when people say it's bee barf, well, not exactly. You know, yes, it does in its own way. It does get regurgitated, and it passes from bee to bee to bee in order to dry out and to get more and more invertase to speed that process. But in the sense that they're digesting it in terms of using it in their own way, no, that doesn't happen.
All right, this is not a bee meal that has been lost accidentally.
Right, okay. Exactly.
All right, that's an important distinction. I'm glad you cleared that up for us. We have a phone call here from Mark in Redding. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sharon Schmidt from the Oregon Honey and Mead Festival and Amina Harris from the Pollination Center at UC Davis. Go ahead, Mark.
Yes. I'm wondering, do honeybees use oleander as a nectar source, and if they do, would the honey therefrom be poisonous?
That's an excellent question. Thanks for that, Mark. So if the plant is toxic, is there nectar from it that will end up in toxic honey?
No, and oleander isn't a nectar source for bees, so you won't see them in it, and they don't collect it, though oleander is incredibly toxic to human beings and other animals. For instance, one of the plants that is toxic for bees, and they do collect it, is the wild buckeye that grows all over California. I actually don't know if it grows in Oregon, but it has it's in the chestnut family, has a big nut on it. Do you have that?
What's the first thing to bloom
and the first thing to drop leaves in our foothills here.
And what's the plant again? I'm sorry.
It's called the buckeye.
Oh, do we not have Buckeyes here, do we? No.
Rarely.
Okay.
You know, it's sort of like Ohio State Buckeyes running around.
Right, right, right. I remember the Buckeye leaves on the helmets and everything, sure.
Right, well, and that's what it is, actually. It's a huge nut. But the bees collect that. Usually they're collecting it when there's a lot of other stuff in bloom, like blackberry and, you know, wildflowers and all kinds of stuff. But occasionally it's the only thing blooming. If bees collect that, they will die. And buckwheat honey is a very, very light honey. It's really good, and it's not harmful to us at all. So, you know, that's one where it's toxic to the animal but not toxic to us. I don't know specifically, like, I've heard of poison oak honey. I've never tasted it. I have heard that it also isn't toxic to us, and it's not toxic to bees. So I don't know about one that is actually would hit the toxicity thing in both places.
Sharon Schmidt, I saw a glimmer of recognition when she was talking about poison oak honey. Is that something you've been experienced?
Yes, yeah. I have actually, and it was very delicious. But I will tell you that I did have a stomach ache afterwards.
Did you really?
I think that must be unique to me because I know a lot of people who eat it and enjoy it, and I think it's produced by TED Talk here regionally.
So Amina is the one who knows all about the honeys and does the honey tasting. And in fact, I have your honey flavor wheel in front of me. Sharon brought it in with her and some honey samples as well. What do you do when you're first getting people to taste test honey?
Well, the first thing you have to overcome is there's two things. People often say, oh, I smell sweet, because that's the first thing you do is you smell.
Mm-hmm.
And honey doesn't have a whole lot of volatile pieces to it, so you've got to warm it up in your hands and get it to a place that it might actually let some smell out. If you have a whole jar and you take the lid off and the lid's been on a long time, it always has an aroma of one kind or another. I always love it when someone says, it smells sweet, but the fact is you can't smell sweet. And so now you're into the place where you're talking sensory science, and you have to help that person understand that what they're doing is they're associating something that they know is sweet, and they're giving it that name. So instead of figuring out, gee, what is it that's sweet that I'm smelling, they're just calling it the smell sweet. So it's a nuanced kind of thing, but it's what happens in all sensory science throughout the country, in terms of trying to figure out the language that should be used.
So, Amina, I've just provided Jeffrey a jar of honey that was produced at UC Davis, so you know which one that is.
Oh, is that the coriander?
Well, you weren't supposed to tell him.
Oh, no, I thought it was coriander. I mean, when I was trying to figure out of all the kitchen spices, it smells like one I don't use very much. I thought it was coriander. There it is.
Good nose.
All right.
It probably smells a little bit more, if you identified it as a kitchen spice, so that was good. It probably actually smells more like cardamom.
Okay. Which I probably couldn't differentiate. Those are the two spices I don't use a great deal in the kitchen, but
right.
But it's
actually differentiated the other day. He was from India.
Okay. Yeah, so the spicing is part of your culture.
No, I said this is one you smell out in the marketplace all the time, and he went, "Oh, cardamom."
Okay, so I'm even going to offer the tasting fork to get a taste of the coriander. It's like I can do this without getting it all over the electronics here. Wow. It's interesting. It's a bit of a burn, a bit of an afterburn, isn't it?
Some people say there is a bit of an afterburn. You know, what's also interesting is that we all taste differently. So when you start to categorize honeys, as you do with wine and everything else, you have to kind of come up with a medium. And I haven't run this one by a whole lot of people, but the profiles that they have out of Italy are pretty similar. The coriander honey that they taste in Italy, which comes mostly from Romania, is will taste exactly the same. However, I don't know if it has that little hot hit that you get at the end of this one. And I've noticed it repeatedly. So, and people bring it up all the time.
So I've just now provided Jeffrey the other jar of honey, the one that was produced at Glory Bee. So mm-hmm. You know which one that one is.
Okay, I'll keep my mouth shut.
Just based on experience, I've used clover honey, have used it, and I think that's mm-hmm. what it smells like to me.
Nope.
Nope, okay. What is it?
This is coffee blossom.
Coffee blossom? From actual coffee trees?
From actual coffee trees.
Wow.
Right, this comes from Mexico.
So when you're doing a taste testing, Amina, what do you do for a sort of a between samples palate cleanser or something? What's the usual medium for getting back to it?
Actually, bubble water is probably the easiest. Some people use apple slices, like a green apple, you know, Granny Smith's or something, because it's so sweet you want something that's going to, like, scrape your tongue if you're going to do that. So it's not something you just want to, like, drink a sip of water, though that works for many people. If you're really experienced, you can just move one to the next. But in the beginning, it's like watching people glaze over after they've had six is about a max. And that, I think six is what we'll be tasting. I'm not sure if we're doing five or six at the... I have to put that all together this afternoon. But I've one of the things I'm trying to do more and more is to train people to understand that, yes, there are varietal honeys, and every single one does have its own profile, but within those, mostly what we're always eating is wildflower. Mm-hmm. And so the trick is to understand what you're tasting within the wildflower, and all these characteristics that you get from varietals show up in wildflower. Many of them are there. So, you know, wildflower in Oregon is going to have all kinds of stuff in it. It's going to have a hint of meadow foam. It's going to have a hint of blackberry. You know, it's going to have all these blueberry maybe. You just don't know where the bees have gone. They can travel 5 miles in any direction, which is 87 square miles. That's a lot of territory.
You know, the coffee blossom version I just had, it used a lot more of my tongue, I noticed. that rather than the tip of the tongue, it seemed like it hit the sides. I was kind of feeling it in my jaw.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I've never heard that good description. But it does. It gets all over. Now, what's interesting about coffee, coffee honey, is that it can be collected anywhere they produce coffee. Not everybody's collecting the honey, but you have to have some kind of pollination for the coffee, so usually there's bees nearby. But just like coffee varies from locale to locale, and we talk about that as terroir, the coffee honey actually varies in flavor from locale to locale. The exact same thing happens.
Okay, sure,
so
yeah.
It's one of the few honeys that really changes a lot depending where you're getting it from.
And so Sharon,
coffee honey off of Hawaii is really different than coffee honey from Mexico.
Oh, makes sense. Okay, so we're down to our last few seconds here, and Sharon just put another jar in front of me, which all I could say is it smells kind of flowery, and I can't figure out anything beyond that.
And that's a wildflower honey from my hive in Phoenix.
There we go, wildflower honey. Okay. It's always interesting to have Sharon Schmidt in here with the jars of honey from the Oregon Honey and Mead Festival coming up on Saturday at, you got the Ashland Springs Hotel for the breakfast, and then the rest of the events at the Elks Lodge in Ashland?
Right, and then Sunday we have the Beloved Benefit. Jen Ambrose and Annie Ville are coming in to do some beautiful music for us, and we'll be indoors for all these events. So if anybody wants something fun to do with their kids over the weekend, this is the place to go.
The Oregon Honey and Mead Festival, Amina's Tasting, will be noon to 1 at, looks like, over at the Ashland Springs Hotel. So thank you both for joining us. Amina Harris is the director of the Honey and Pollination Center at UC Davis. Sharon Schmidt, a beekeeper and the founder of the Oregon Honey and Mead Festival. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange, and thanks for the honey.
Thank you.